Let's go.
The most energetic, fit, and stress-resilient people on the planet practice daily habits to keep their hormones balanced, their gut healthy, and their muscles and mind strong. Welcome to That Fitness Couple. We're Mike and Corey Beth Lepowski, founders of Pure Physique.
This podcast is designed to provide you with everything we've discovered and continue to discover about nutrition, training, and lifestyle. Today, we all live hectic lives.
So we've made it our mission to make your fitness time efficient and to build you up. Hope you share and enjoy. Let's dive into today's episode.
Let's go.
Today, we're talking with Sally Norton, the author of the book, Toxic Superfoods. Sally holds a nutrition degree from Cornell University and a master's degree in public health from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And she was a faculty member of the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Behavioral and Environmental Health. What you'll learn in this interview is that her formal background in study of nutrition at these prestigious universities was not enough to properly equip her in addressing her own health challenges, despite her being a, quote, healthy eater. She wound up going down a completely ignored path of oxalate toxicity in order to find the root cause of her issues. Now, as the listener, we think you're going to be shocked to learn what health foods have been slowly destroying your health and are at the root cause of many illnesses and diseases. And while this information will come off as shocking to some, Sally is in no way fear-mongering. She brings the science to back up her statements and provides some of the most practical advice ever given on this show. Now, before we get going, please take a moment to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as share the show with others so that we can get this information in the hands of more people and help them learn how to eat and exercise to lose fat, look fit, and live healthy. All right. Well, Sally, we are really excited to have you on today.
It's fun to be with you guys. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, Corey Beth, you want to kick this off with some true and false for Sally?
Yes. Our first true and false question, which you can answer true, false, or true with a caveat, or false with a caveat, is a spinach smoothie is the best way to start your day.
False.
You once believed sweet potatoes, Swiss chard, and spinach were the healthiest superfoods.
Oh, no, they're terrible.
But you once believed that they were good. Yes,
I did believe that. Well, yeah.
Us too.
They were special. I did.
This may be shocking, but vegetable consumption can cause kidney stones.
Yes.
All right.
True.
Four, this one's going to hit some people pretty hard. Dark chocolate and almonds can be dangerous for our health.
That is true.
Anemia is not something that we can address with food.
Oh, that's false.
Number six, we can address fibromyalgia and rheumatoid arthritis through diet.
Yes, we can.
Amazing. And then the last one was kind of fun for me. Hiccups are not random. They are actually a sign that something in your body is off.
That is true.
Oh, well, this is going to be great. Why don't we dive on in? I know, Mike, you want to talk a bit about Sally's book, and then let's go back through these true and false questions.
Yeah. I mean, as we were saying before we got on, I mean, I absolutely devoured Sally's book, Toxic Superfoods. I thought it was outstanding. And, you know, as I mentioned to you, Sally, it was like the perfect blend of providing the science, yet at the same time, helping the layman understand what it is about certain foods that we really need to be watching out for. And before we really dive deep into it, what I'd like to do is actually just start with the title of the book, Toxic Superfoods. So why don't we begin by just talking generally about which foods are the ones that we should be viewing as toxic?
Generally, well, foods that are full of chemicals that are messing with our biology. And unfortunately, that's been out of the conversation. So we don't even have an idea about it. And we have this idea that plants have magic compounds that just fix you up, make you awesome, make you live to 600. We have a superfood concept and we're promoting these, quote, superfoods. And I think these plants have special superpowers to protect themselves and that it works for them. And we have misunderstood how these chemicals work. And they're actually quite noxious to many aspects of our metabolism, way down at the cellular level, at the barrier function level of our bodies. That's how we protect ourselves from threats. with the lining of your digestive tract, for example, you can really mess it up using these foods that we think are so wonderful, that we trust. You're trusting them and you could be unawarely undermining your goal.
Well, we're going to definitely get into some of the specific foods. We've already alluded to some. Before we get into that, and before we even talk about which toxins specifically that you outline in the book, what are some of the things that physically, the physical ailments, the symptoms, the diseases that these quote unquote superfoods can actually lead to?
Wow, the list is tremendous. It sounds unbelievable that like all the diseases that are plaguing us now, pain syndromes, mood problems, digestive disorders, connective tissue problems, including osteopenia and osteoporosis, and inflammatory problems with arthritis and all the itises. And I keep coming up with more names for all these weird things that are happening to people. Skin problems, urinary tract and pelvic issues, such as kidney stones, bladder stones, irritable bladder, painful bladder, nighttime urination, frequent urination, genital pain, and maybe prostatitis, all kinds of yucky things in the pelvis, anemia, vascular problems, maybe cancer, certainly dementia and the degeneration of our nervous system. Many of these diseases like MS are becoming more prevalent earlier in life. All of these are ways that the cells are struggling and going wrong, and something's in there mucking them up. And it turns out that this chemical that I'm focusing on with my book, Toxic Superfoods, has the power to do that.
And so what is that toxin specifically?
It's called oxalates or oxalate, and its parent compound is oxalic acid. Made by plants in nature, the oxalic acid grabs minerals and becomes oxalate salt. The most popular one, or you know, most prevalent common one in nature, is calcium oxalate. That is what a kidney stone is made out of.
What I found so interesting about this is, you know, many people listening to this right now, this is going to be the first time that they've ever heard of oxalates or oxalic acid. And yet you pointed out in the book that this is something that was pretty commonly discussed in the literature. It was pointed out by doctors as potential cause for a lot of ailments that people were suffering from. I mean, dating back like almost 100 years ago. So, I mean, I think that we can probably guess that a lot of the reason why this has been suppressed up until now is because of how much the fruit and vegetables have been promoted and pushed over the past several decades. But in your research, I mean, what were some of the things that back then that they were seeing that we're only now becoming smart to?
Yeah. And then just to give a little slight correction on the timeline, really, it was about 180 years ago when this really came in the fore as a diagnosis, that if you overate rhubarb and other high oxalate foods, at the time, they weren't aware that potatoes were high, for example, and sweet potatoes weren't really that big a thing. In England, where this was really being identified, was in primarily the UK and Europe, who were the leaders in science at the time. And they already had a name for this disorder. If you ate too much rhubarb, and when rhubarb was in season, you could get really sick. And what they were seeing was major mood changes, where you'd become kind of neurotic and depressed and anxious and hard to work with. Like, that was a major feature. But in the diagnosis schema, digestive problems were the centerpiece. So someone would have digestive problems, and they would have either neurological problems with their mood or pain or sleep and that kind of thing. Even clumsiness, like just really being off, losing your eye-hand coordination. You know, eye-hand coordination requires the physiology to work well. And when your nerves are stressed out, you lose some of that, which really matters in sports and fitness, right? And then there's the connective tissue thing they would see. So it was either stomach problems and the nerve problem, or stomach problems and rheumatological problems with arthritis and pain and, you know, stuff that makes your muscles and joints unhappy. Another big thing, you get into a lot of tennis elbow, carpal tunnel, and in fact, they were even using the low oxalate diet to reverse carpal tunnel like symptoms well over 100 years ago. But it was really about 100 years ago now where it was starting to be dropped out of the medical literature. So we had about 100 years of recognizing that the oxalates in our foods, at a time when we really couldn't measure them that well, but it was still really obvious that it was oxalate causing the disease, because at that time we had seasonality in the diet. So these symptoms would tend to happen with more people at certain times of the year. and it would make it easier to identify it. And then we invented the refrigerator and the train and the truck and the grocery store. And now you can get any of these foods year round. So you've lost that seasonality. So you don't see it as well. And we've got a completely different attitude in healthcare, where before, say, 1940, you talked to your patient, you used your experience clinically, you did a physical exam, you asked them about their lifestyle and their stress, and you did this sort of artful picture. And now we just run tests and we expect the blood to show everything. And that is a great way to hide a problem like toxicity from plants, because it won't show up in the bloodstream, or even urine tests often miss it.
Oh, I mean, that there are so many places we can go right that now with this. Let's see. I guess the first one would be around tests, because, you know, you bring up in the book, again, this plethora of symptoms that people will experience. But how does somebody diagnose that they may have this toxic overload going on in their body?
Well, it's sort of about the exposure, vulnerability, and then are symptoms showing up or not, and being able to connect them. I have a symptoms and exposure inventory on my website and in the book, where you can go through a checklist and say, do I have risk factors for being especially vulnerable to exposure? We're all vulnerable to exposure to toxins. No one gets a pass on any toxin, be it mercury, lead, arsenic, smoke in the air, oxalates in your food. It's just some bodies are able to hide it and manage it in ways where it doesn't necessarily cause too much grief in the early phases, but it can add up to things that we just consider normal. You know, you turn 40 and they start blaming your age and your hormones. And then they start getting other things that are aging that really could just be the accumulation of too much oxalate. I mean, just keep it with oxalate alone is enough. You don't need all the other problems in plant foods. So the symptoms, where are we going with this?
I think this is a great time to loop back to our true and false and kind of walk through some of these things. Yep. Because I think for many people, we have been programmed or conditioned to think that if we have a superfood smoothie, that's a great thing. And when we even just look at the word superfood, I mean, they're superheroes. It's good to have spinach and kale and Swiss chard and all these things. Can you explain to our listeners why spinach, which on your interview with Judy Cho, she was saying she was eating upwards of a pound of spinach a day. I mean, back in the day, we were making spinach smoothies. We had made them for our kids. We called them Hulk smoothies. I mean, I'm sure a lot of listeners can relate to that, because that's what we were told is healthy. Why isn't that such a great idea, Sally?
Oh my gosh. The oxalate level in spinach, chard, and beet greens, these are the dark leafy greens, is off the charts high, way past what we can tolerate. We have kidneys that help get it out of our bloodstream. You know, if you have a high calcium diet, there's certain ways the body will try to not absorb too much, but it just gets in. It's such a tiny little chemical. We're talking about oxalic acid. It's a free ion. It's very rough and corrosive to cells, and it's just 2 carbons and 4 oxygens. It's very small, just a diluted little ion, like a little thing floating in water, and just gets in your bloodstream. And now your kidneys have to get rid of it. And this is what we can handle is about 5 spinach leaves a day worth of oxalate. And in either cooked spinach dishes, what, you know, collapses from this big box down to this little handful when you cook it, or when you puree it in the blender, it just doesn't seem like much at all. And yet it is a very concentrated source of oxalic acid. I think you could use those old smoothies and literally clean your patio. It would get the rust off your patio. You could clean an old rusty radiator, pour it in the radiator and get rid of all the rust, because this oxalate will grab the iron and grab minerals and clean it. We use it to polish brass and monuments and clean bleach wood, fabric, leather. It's been used in industry as an industrial cleaner because of its ability to grab minerals since the 1770s, something like that.
How did it get in our literature of this is something that's healthy and good and going to make you strong?
Well, you know, when you test it in the lab, it looks like it has a lot of minerals in it, and you want minerals. We early on in the nutrition field, when we were getting very scientific and trying to figure out the chemistry of food and what we needed out of it, you know, biologically, minerals were an important focus, as were discovering the vitamins. And in this era of discovering the vitamins, we would use food tests. It was also an era of industry providing food for us. It's like more people were working in cities and weren't on farms and didn't have big root cellars full of canned goods that they made from their gardens anymore. And people were having to buy tin can food. And tin can, I mean, you could have my beautiful glass that I made at home. Why would I buy your tin can? So the marketers wanted to say that these are nutritious foods. They're safe for your family. So they were testing canned foods to see if they would ruin the rat's health or not. And they would. One guy was using spinach to add calcium because he was sure that the canned tin foods didn't have enough calcium. And it looked like spinach had calcium. He should have already known by now. We already knew by the mid-1930s that the calcium in the spinach is zero calcium nutritionally because of the oxalic acid binding that calcium. In fact, there's enough oxalic acid in spinach. Some studies suggest that not only you get zero calcium from your spinach, but you get negative calcium because there's enough free oxalic acid there that it's pulling calcium from the other foods you're eating. Or if it gets into your body, it's not yet grabbed much calcium. It's really just the free ion that's able to pull the calcium out of your blood or your blood cells or your tissues, wherever it gets to. At some point, it can grab various nutritional minerals. So we measure it in a lab, spinach, oh, calcium, but do not have often not discerned the difference between calcium that's bioavailable that you can use nutritionally versus calcium that's toxic because it's oxalate.
I'm glad you brought up calcium because that was one thing that I wanted to speak about. You made mention earlier too that oxalates are related to osteopenia, maybe osteoporosis. So is it because that the oxalates for some people who eat it in excess are actually leaching calcium from their bones?
Absolutely. Right. It's being leached from the body fluids and the bloodstream. And if you don't have enough calcium in your blood, your heart doesn't work properly. Right. And you've got to keep your pH correct and the minerals. The calcium is chalk. It's a nice alkalizing molecule. So you need to keep your electrolytes and minerals correct in the blood. And if you start sucking them out of your body, the bank to find more calcium to correct those imbalances is your bones. So you keep going in and taking withdrawals from your bones every time you eat a high oxalate meal, like a spinach smoothie or a piece of keto bread, because almonds are really high, peanuts are high. We grow up on potatoes and peanuts and then chocolate. And then we get convinced that in order to be allowed to eat all that terrible stuff, we should have more spinach.
Well, on the chocolate and the almonds, I think what was super fascinating for me was hearing you say how almonds are actually so hard on our teeth. And that in fact, people who will eat, you know, apples and almond butter is right. That's healthier than apples and peanut butter. Now we have almond butter on the scene that women were actually, or people grinding their teeth down to the point where they were damaging their teeth just from the consumption of almond butter.
Yeah. Isn't that surprising? And we're not really documenting that in science much anymore, but where you see it in the literature is looking at old skulls with the teeth in them. When you're digging up remains of ancient civilizations, they look at what they call dental microwear, and they look for these little calcium oxalate crystals in the area where these people were, you know, throwing away things or cooking their meals or whatever. And they would find what they call phytoliths, which are calcium oxalate crystals in the plants they were using and eating. And they would see that they would be eating, say, cactus, which is very high in calcium oxalate and oxalic acid. And in Southwest Texas, there was an ancient society there that lost all their teeth by the time they were in their 30s. They were all start falling out by the time they're in their 20s because they were trying to live on high oxalate cactus. And you see the teeth wearing away both from the outside and the inside. And often in the literature, they're emphasizing these little crystals of calcium oxalate are literally, so they're so much harder than the teeth and they're persistent. You know, we're looking at something from 50,000 years ago or something, really. And they still can find the calcium oxalate crystals and document what kind of foods they were eating. That's why they're looking for the calcium oxalate crystals, because they'll be slightly different morphologies in different plants. And that will help them confirm that these people were probably living on, say, nopal cactus as a staple food, which was causing this dental microwear that literally wore down their teeth to the pulp and also causing erosion from the bloodstream side, because a tooth is a living tissue. It has blood flow in it. And so this is the jaw the gums, the teeth are all being fed by blood flow. And your blood levels go up and oxalate after you eat it. For the next 8 hours or more after you eat the food, your blood levels of oxalate, they're peaking at about 4 hours after you eat it. So the poor dentition is getting it from when you're eating it and chewing on the crystals and having oxalic acid in your mouth. Then it's coming through your mouth and teeth and everything through the capillaries. And it's also coming back into the mouth through the saliva, because the saliva glands excrete oxalate at a level where your oxalate level in your saliva will be 10 or 30 times higher with the level in your blood. So 4 hours after a spinach smoothie, your saliva is high and you're corroding your dental health at three different levels of exposure in the mouth.
I think that this is like a good place to pause for a moment, because people, I'm sure their heads are spinning. How do you arrive here? Like, how did you show up to discover all about oxalates? I mean, give everybody a little background on you.
Yeah, I would never have predicted this when I, at seventh grade, decided I would study nutrition to help people not get cancer, heart disease, and be able to live a productive, happy life and not have to be around doctors much. That was my intention. And so I've been doing nutrition geek thing a long time. In fact, I even would come home from kindergarten and say, "Mommy, we're supposed to eat." So I love my vegetables as a kid. I was the one of the five kids who would love their vegetables and eat them and be like, "Look, Sally will eat it." Like, the rest of them really weren't into it. And, you know, I thought that was a good thing. I got into gardening too. I was starting to garden at age 9, had a big plot with this rich soil, and you could just drop seeds where I'm from and beets would come out. And we'd love to pick the beets young and tender and cook them with the greens as a family. My mom encouraged me to grow Swiss chard because it was a cut and come vegetable. I've been eating Swiss chard. Rhubarb, she had it behind the garage. We would play with it as girls and we would eat it as a dessert. And I was surrounded by oxalates as a kid and didn't have the greatest health. In fact, needed glasses in 10th grade. I was the only one of the five of us who needed glasses as a kid. And then by the time I was 21, I was in bifocals from my healthy diet. It turns out that didn't help. And, you know, so I'm just following along what I've been taught. And at Cornell, where I studied my nutrition program, one of the professors has been an advocate for vegetarian and preferably veganism, doesn't like dairy foods at all. So I bought into that and I read books like Francis Moore LePay's Diet for a Small Planet and then Diet for a New America and all this plant enthusiasm. And it turns out that really what they were promoting was the idea of civic engagement and changing the world. And it was, you know, maybe saving the animals. And it was really then with this fake nutrition argument over the top of it that even my professors at Cornell were willing to play along with. And it's really easy to just ignore stuff you don't want to be true, whether you're a PhD, whether you're at an Ivy League university. And so I was part of that world. And I, you know, I got my master's in public health, again, interested in prevention and aging and fitness, focused on fitness and breath work and poor elders. And this is like, we all thought that if we ate more plants, that was going to be safe, that somehow they were benign. So it took me a long time to realize that my lifetime of health struggles was related to my healthy diet. Shouldn't that have made sense to me sooner? Shouldn't I realize that I believe that nutrition is the basis for health? And if you eat right, you won't get sick. And here I'm sick and I can't connect it to my sweet potato habit and my good plant-based eating. It took a long time to get there, because the more you think you know, the harder it is to contribute to you, because you've already got your whole system in your head for how you see how, you know, the stuff that's been installed in your head. It seems like truth, but it's really just your map of how. It's an abstract map of how things might work in reality. And that map prevents us from really seeing things from a fresh perspective. And the beautiful thing about me finally having this breakthrough and a health breakthrough by getting rid of the sweet potatoes I was eating, the Swiss chard, wasn't that many high oxalate foods in my diet. It was really, I was down to those two as my main problems and I couldn't see it. I love sweet potatoes. I was practically addicted to them. And so the revelation of recognizing that this stuff is so pernicious is in a way really refreshing, because you get a clean slate. If you can realize that you've been, this whole structure in your head is built on a house of cards. It's built on a lot of wishful thinking and mythology and marketing. And why the spinach smoothie and the chia seed and all this stuff is so popular right now, this is really marketing. And marketing is reality. What we hear over and over again, what everyone's like having a party over because somebody's making money on it, is your truth. But your truth could be really screwing you.
How did you discover, though, oxalates as being the issue? I mean, and it's interesting, too, because you said it earlier, and we hear it all the time. People show up to the doctor, talk to them about the numerous symptoms that they're experiencing, and you know, we're quick to give somebody a resolution in pill form, but nobody asks, what's your diet like? Or what are you eating? And so how did you stumble upon this?
In fact, what the usual situation with oxalate poisoning is you look okay. Your tests look fine. They all the tests they can do, even if they get as fancy as MRIs and CT scans, you know, sometimes your ultrasound will find big, hard, lumpy, like my doctor did find the lumpy thyroid gland. He's like, you got one. We got to send you for these ultrasounds. The ultrasounds are like, well, oh, yeah, something. But there's no like your diet gave you big, hard, lumpy because a thyroid gland is a commonplace, very commonplace for oxalate crystals to collect. So basically anyone who's over age 15 is developing, because you've had enough years by 15, you're developing little micro kidney stones in your thyroid gland. This is a master gland. It can also affect your pituitary, which then affects your thyroid, your adrenals, all the glands tend to collect it. So how I discovered this was, I had gotten to the point where I was really struggling with work. And initially in 2009, I had this attack of vulvar pain, which is when it's going, it's quite disruptive. And I was like immediately over it. Like, please get rid of this problem. And the only thing I think of was like, well, let's just cut off your genitals. Like, it was like, no. I literally said that out loud in the house. Like, somebody cut these off because I don't want them anymore. And I had a couple of days of this, like 2 or 3 days of it, and I was over it. Some women suffer with this kind of pain for decades. I don't know how it's terrible. My husband looked it up online and found the Vulvar Pain Foundation. Like, there's a Vulvar Pain Foundation that lived right close to me. I used to be at UNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and she's just 30 minutes west of there. And I didn't know about her. And her information didn't convince me because, like I said, I had my own way of thinking and none of what she was saying stuck. And it wasn't coming from the scientific place I need to think through. I can't just take someone's opinion. I need to hear, like, show me the science. So I didn't really get that I needed to really be seriously off the sweet potatoes, because when I would get off of them and then eat them again, I didn't notice it made me worse. I didn't see any vulvar pain coming back. That just disappeared. So I didn't connect it. And that's where we get into the confusing part about oxalates. Because when you stop eating them, you're still toxic with oxalate because it's sitting in your thyroid gland, in your bone marrow, in your kidneys, and in your tendons, and in your neck, and maybe in your teeth and saliva glands. So now you still have oxalates. But when you quit eating them, this gives the body the moment it's been looking for to clean it out. Cleaning it out often means dissolving it down out of the tissues, which requires a lot of inflammation and can create symptoms. This is tough work. It's hazmat work. Dissolving it back down to oxalic acid, putting it back into the bloodstream, which is more toxic all over again. Recycling a toxic experience and reliving it again and again and again is not necessarily what you want to do. And then it's got to come back out again, usually through the kidneys, although the intestines can help. The skin can help. Some people get literal reactions when they quit eating the oxalates. They'll get a big rash, eye styes, boils, stuff flaking off, peeling skin. But a lot of us, it's the kidneys having to do it, and you get cloudy urine. And that's a sign of a lot of crystals causing light to bounce off. The urine is sitting in the toilet bowl, and you can see it's like kind of milky. Have you seen that ever before?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's my mind is exploding as you're saying this. And I feel like it's such important things for people to know, because we know that causation doesn't always mean correlation. And so for me, I've gone primarily meat and animal based since the first of this year. And the woman that does my facial said, oh, you're developing some rosacea. So of course, my first thought is, oh my gosh, maybe it's the meat. And then I had some cloudy urine and I'm like, oh my gosh, maybe it's the meat. And so most people that are not really on a self-discovery, self-healing journey like we are here will say, I got to stop eating meat. Let me go right back to the vegetables and the salads. But I kept on pushing. And what I've noticed are my urine has cleared up and I no longer have this rosacea. So I'm now wondering, you saying this is a big epiphany for me. Maybe my body did have to go through that detox about 3, 4, 5 months in. And now here we are at month 6. I don't have those symptoms anymore.
You're just getting a small vacation.
Oh, great. Good to know.
Chances are, if you were doing these really high oxalate things like spinach smoothies, you have at least a 10-year journey ahead of you.
Wow.
Yeah. This is why I'm squeaking about this issue, because it's not a quick fix necessarily. Wow. I'm still clearing oxalates. I was seeing peeling skin and some cloudy urine and really bad stiff neck and pain in my upper neck and shoulders just a couple of weeks ago, 10 days ago. Another round of this inflammation that comes on, releasing of the oxalate crystals. I know I still have a lot of oxalate affecting my spinal tissues, the discs, the bones, the tendons, the ligaments, and I'm still working on that because I'm old lady now. I'm almost 60, and it was a long lifetime of perfect eating that has me loaded with this stuff.
I know that some listeners may be thinking now, wait a second, I don't want a 10-year journey. I don't want to go through neck pain or rosacea or whatever it might be. What happens if they don't give their body that time like we are right now to allow it to detox, allow it to cleanse out? They just keep eating the Swiss chard and the spinach. What does that outcome look like?
Feeble, weak, old age with probably an injury that will cause a bone break. You'll have weak bones, weak connective tissue, and you may lose your teeth or have tooth pain problems. You may end up with problems with mood and cognition and start to become like, you know, struggle with your memory. You could end up with individual, you know, you could end up with various places like your saliva stones or your kidneys or so on, collecting this oxalate that could become a health crisis out of the blue. There are plenty of reports in the medical literature of people getting away with the high antioxidant polyphenol diet with tomato paste and almond butter and almond milk and these healthy, all these things that are really considered healthy. Most of them have high oxalate. So if you start really pounding on them to make sure you have a healthy old age, you will a break, probably with a kidney stone event or some other kind of event. I think it can even, you could suddenly just have a heart attack or start having heart problems and it could be related.
Wow. Two questions off of this then is, one, what is the approach? And it's outlined in the book, so we don't need to go into deep detail about it, but I think it would be good to give everybody an overview of the process of detoxing oxalates from the body. And then the follow-up question would be, well, what about those people though, that they do have a relationship, if you will, with vegetables and they're just not ready to give up all vegetables? I mean, does this mean that they have to go full-blown carnivore, or could they still keep some vegetables in their diet? And I know you have a great list in your book of like the worst offenders and the safe bets. So let's just start with the first question, though, around how somebody would start this process.
You would start the process doing a bit of a self-assessment. So like the symptom and inventory tool that I have, take a look at your exposure to oxalate now in the past. And what are the foods that are really in your day-to-day life that are in this worst offenders list? And get a plan to get them off of dinner. Get them out of this back half of your day and just see if you can do dinner without Swiss chard and sweet potatoes. Come up with a meal without it. It doesn't matter in terms of oxalate how much meat you replace that with. You can replace it with other vegetables. You can still remain even vegetarian and still get great benefits, get rid of your gout, get rid of this and that, and feel better, start sleeping better without having to upheave your current philosophy about how to eat. So you really don't have to do this fast. It's better to take your time and fumble around slightly, be imperfect human with it, but really start learning what those high oxalate foods are and start to see them. Start to put on oxalate glasses when you start seeing your food choices. There's always something else you can eat. If there's a food that's on the worst offenders list that you think you can't live without, that's just not true. You can live without it and you'll live a much better life without it, but you don't even have to get rid of it 100%. You know, if you've been eating a whole can of olives because they're keto, well, cut that back to like 6 or 7 olives at a time, twice a day. And then that's a huge difference. It's really about dosing this and bringing us out of what I call the danger zone of exposure with these spinach smoothies and chia bowls and keto bread and almond butter on everything. And then if you're going on, some people have put themselves necessarily on a gluten-free diet, and they're living on not just the almond flour, but things like buckwheat and quinoa. These are very high in oxalates. So if you've gone from the frying pan into the fire, like gluten was bad enough, now you're eating quinoa, you know, we have to rethink that. And so being open-minded to learn this basic thing and be ready for an experiment. And then the next thing is to understand this process of the body managing it. At some point, you get yourself out of danger zone and come down into a level that's more what the doctors and researchers think is normal, which is like 150 milligrams a day, with whereas a spinach smoothie is like 1,000, right? Mm-hmm. Or a handful of almonds is, I don't know, like 75, gets you halfway to your daily capacity. If you get down, if you take this stuff down enough, you get into the normal zone, you may start to get into this lovely honeymoon period where things are coming in and aren't coming out and not mobilizing too much. You don't have too much oxalic acid floating around in your blood, way less coming into your kidneys, way less irritating your brain and ruining your sleep. And you start to feel better. Some people, if they jump all the way down to zero to carnivore, it's very different too. Like some people right away on carnivore, they start getting stuff like you're describing, and it can escalate for them and they can get really sick because they're so loaded. Their system is so ready to just sort of puke it out. Other people have come to me and say, I was perfect on carnivore, which is a zero oxalate diet because the meat and the animal foods don't have any appreciable amounts of oxalate in them. So if you go completely off the plants onto zero plants, you've jumped from a big mess probably down to zero. And for some people, that is so abrupt that just gets this whole clearing thing going in ways that can make them sick. And other people, it doesn't show up for 3 or even 6 years.
Wow. I mean, I think that that's what's so fascinating. Obviously, how different and unique each of us are, but you don't know when it's going to show up. And most people will say, right, yesterday I ate a piece of cheesecake and I took some vitamins and now I have a stomach ache. It must be the vitamins, right? They don't look at the whole picture. They'll look at what was right close or maybe what they want to see, or maybe their blueprint in their brain says it could never be my salads. It must be this piece of steak. You know, I got to stop eating that.
Well, wasn't that it with you? I mean, you described how you were so deep into this. I mean, this is what you studied. This is what you were doing, teaching, right? And now all of a sudden it's like your world is getting flipped upside down. And I think though your story is so relevant to people because they find themselves also in that place of like cognitive bias in a certain way. And it's just the importance of keeping your mind active and willing to explore what has become your blueprint and asking yourself, hey, maybe this blueprint, there's some things in here that are off, and going down that road. But I think just exposing this conversation by itself, I mean, even if you take oxalates out of the equation and we talk about, you know, this clearing, that maybe it's not oxalate that your body is clearing, maybe it's something else. This idea that we start to go down a path and we're going down the right path and we find ourselves in this period of clearing. Now all these negative symptoms are coming up and we're like falsely blaming,
yeah,
you know, the good thing that we're doing on it. I mean, I jumped to full-blown carnivore and had no issue. It's been almost a year. In fact, I had to do it because I found that I was fructose intolerant. And that was, you know, putting me on the couch after a lunchtime salad with spinach and berries in it, along with my grilled chicken. And so I made the leap, and happily so, because I was never a big vegetable fan. I just think it's interesting how people's journeys can be so different. But I think just bringing this realization that, hey, this clearing thing is for real. And you point that out a lot in the book as well.
Well, listening to your body is really the crux of the matter. But knowing the language and understanding and being open to just, I don't really know what this means, but I'm seeing this happening. I don't know what this means, but I'm willing to acknowledge that something's happening and I need to keep wondering what is going on. I need to keep asking the world, the universe, God, like, what does this mean? Fatigue after a meal is definitely some kind of allergic-y kind of intolerance. So if a meal makes you feel terrible, I had trouble admitting that to myself with beef because I was pretty darn carnivore. So I went on the full carnivore diet on April 1st of 2019 and couple years ago, I started noticing that I was having a fatigue reaction to these beef meals. And I've been buying beautiful beef from local farms for 20 something years. You know, I get a half cow at a time. It's like perfect we know how it was raised and it's not GMO feed and it's out there in the sun. And I would get not only really tired after a meal, but I would feel this carb craving, like really like fuming for carbs. And it wouldn't happen all the time. It's not going to happen every time. So that's also messes you up and gives you an excuse like, well, it only happens 60% of the time. So we'll just think about that later. And so unfortunately, I put it off so long that I gave myself a big new thyroid nodule, facet joint arthritis up and down my whole spine every day, and lichen sclerosis, which is an autoimmune condition, by ignoring the beef allergy.
Wow. So what does your diet look like? I'm sure a lot of people are curious, and personally, so am I.
Well, those of us who poison ourselves with oxalates tend to have a lot of overreactivity with our immune system and tend to have trained our body to react to lots of different foods. And I don't tolerate a huge amount of what we consider food. So my diet, I'm not doing well in beef. I love lamb and don't eat lamb. I just cooked a goat shank the day before yesterday. I'm going to try that tonight or tomorrow. It's sitting in there getting its flavors together. I'd see how I do on that. I don't do well in chicken. So I eat duck and I eat a lot of fish and pork, butter, and use coconut. Occasionally, I like to use some papaya because I don't do well, as many of us with oxalate poisoning, we're not doing well in the burn fat and proteins for energy and create doing gluconeogenesis all the time. This creates a higher cortisol level and can create issues, makes it harder to sleep and makes it harder to stay perky. So some of us really do need to keep some carbs in the diet, and some people do all right on keto for a while, which carnivore is often close to zero carbs for some people. But you're still basically, if you're eating a high meat diet, you can still call it carnivore and still put in what you need to feel well. So I will occasionally have winter squash, but not, I mean, I really don't do it. I used to be such a vegetable freak. It was a salad plus 2 to 3 side dishes of vegetables like every night, work day or not. Girls are like that, aren't we?
Listen, we were raised, Sally, to eat our vegetables, and you clear your plate of vegetables and you get a side salad. You know, that's what we were taught to do.
Well, it's not just that our parents and kindergarten teachers told us that. It's that when we started hitting adolescence, we started getting weight conscious. And so women are trained during high school to do the whole vegetable and salad thing for vanity's sake. And then we force it on our men.
Reluctantly.
Would rather eat potatoes. Men get their kidney stone with their potato habit, and women do it with their salads.
And if the cops showed up and found Mike in pain on the sofa after a nice, lovely salad I had made in with grilled chicken, they would have thought it was like arsenic poisoning. They would never think that I was poisoning him with salads and fruit.
This is why it's the perfect murder weapon, and which is what stimulated the first really good experimental study on oxalate poisoning that was published in 1823, was the concern that you could use oxalic acid, the cleaner in the household, as a poison and get away with it.
Wow.
So they wanted to know how to look at a cadaver and be able to identify oxalate poisoning, and they could see that that was going to be difficult. But in the process of poisoning like 50 or 70 animals with oxalate, they would force it down the throat and then tie off the throat so they couldn't vomit it out. And then they would, based on different dilutions and quantities, they would write down everything that happened to the animal. And the minute it was officially dead, they would cut it open and examine all the tissues and see what happened to the stomach and the liver and the blood and all this stuff. And they would describe it. They did this over and over again. So much work, because they wanted to be able to take a suspicious death, examine the corpse, and find out if it's oxalate poisoning. So literally, if you have a really like rich uncle, you really should be sending him chocolate covered peanuts and almonds on a weekly basis, because you know, you might inherit sooner and nobody's going to get you for that.
We are not giving advice, nor are we giving legal advice here, but that is so fascinating. And actually, while you're there in that topic, can you just talk about that last true and false we asked about hiccups? Because that really stood out to me, and the rats that hiccuped. I mean, can you walk us through that?
You remember when I said in the 1840s, they said neurological mood changes were a big thing, that you would either have your stomach problems or nerve problems. Well, a hiccup is a nerve toxicity where the nerve is overstimulated and is firing, right? This is what happens when the nerves lose control of their calcium. And it turns out that a hiccup is a neurotoxicity symptom. And I never knew that until I was doing the research and looked at these studies. They were talking about the rats. They would test the rats with, say, star fruit and star fruit juice and so on. And they would talk about neurotoxicity hiccups. I'm like, I never heard that in school or in anatomy and physiology class. They never told me that. And you see it over and over again. And it's, if we see any kind of tremor, twitching, weird stuff, your eyes twitching, so some other part is twitching, even your heart. This could be neurological in nature, because when the nerves are now lost control of their electrolytes, that's so critical, how a nerve fires and doesn't. All cells need this battery charge where they're controlling metal ions, potassium, sodium, calcium, and so on, and moving them around in ways that make things happen and generate energy and so on. So this neuroexcitability that is caused by the oxalate creates tremors and twitches, and sometimes that's hiccup.
Wow.
Or belching can be too.
I'm going to go back though for a moment to the slow death, right? The fact that, you know, many people, and this is not to be this is not about clickbait or anything like that. But what I want to talk about are though the common foods that people are eating on a daily basis, which over time may be contributing to this. And you've made mention of a few already. We know that almonds are a much bigger issue than people realize. And this is probably the reason why when people do go keto, they initially feel good because they got rid of all the processed foods. And but then eventually they get to the point where, okay, now I need my snacks. And every keto snack is loaded with almond flour and things of that sort. But you list out in the book also like the milks, right? There's like almond milk. And what are all of these foods that people are consuming on a daily basis that are contributors, maybe the things that are not quite as obvious?
Bran is one of them. Back in the day when I was coming up, bran was all the thing. And people are now feeding the microbiome, you know, and so there's still some popularity with bran. This bran is the coating of the seed, and that's where the plants will put a lot of oxalate. It helps give sturdiness and protection. It's a place to store calcium. So the outer edge of things that are seeds and the outer coats are worse than all. So the brown rice is worse than the white rice. The whole wheat is worse than the white bread. The wheat germ, the bran. So all the healthy bits in those kind of grainy foods is a disadvantage, not an advantage. And again, in nutrition, we're taught that brown rice has twice the minerals and vitamins as white rice, so therefore eat that. But no real understanding of bioavailability. It doesn't really improve the nutrition of basically a starch. It just gives it more of these problems. And then there's, you know, the chia and hemp thing is big, sesame seeds. The cashews is big, being used as like a dairy substitute is a lot, turned into cheeses and yogurts and so on. The beans, the black beans have been very popular. White beans that you use to make Boston baked beans with, they're very high in oxalate, whereas you can have peas like chickpeas and black-eyed peas and green peas much lower. In spices, it's the turmeric, cumin. Yeah. What else? The fruits, the blackberry, very popular. Star fruit, we don't eat here, but star fruit is like the spinach in Southeast Asia and Brazil. It's considered a health food. So when people get really sick, they start doing star fruit and literally can die from that.
Here's what I really think is interesting too, because when you were talking earlier about when you were growing up and you were growing your food and what have you, you know, you're talking about a very seasonal thing. And I also harken back to the comment that you had made about back in the 1800s and maybe early 1900s when they were seeing the prevalence of these diseases or these symptoms crop up, it was very seasonal. And today, there are no seasons when it comes to our food. And I feel like that is probably also at the crux of the issue, because, you know, you even make mention that having some oxalates in the diet is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we probably do need some in our diet, not in the vast amount that we're taking in. But is that one of the primary reasons why we're seeing the prevalence of these issues, is because the seasonality is no longer a thing?
Yeah, seasonality is a big deal, because if you were to take the winter off, basically we would be more carnivore in the wintertime if we were truly eating seasonal. And then you would have a time when the body could clean out that year's blackberries and sweet potatoes and all. But the other problems include the introduction of foods that we assume people have been eating a long time, which we haven't. Peanuts have only really been a human food since the Civil War and not really used as a commercial human food until about 1910, 1920. So we've really only been eating them about 100 years, but they've been so embedded around the world. Somehow it got is a seasoning in African food and used as snacks in Japan. It's like it's everywhere, even though it was like American Southern pig food. That's we grew peanuts in the South to feed the pigs, but it got turned into human food with technology. And that's true for most of the produce department. Really, we've bred wild plants to make them safer or more edible. The wild carrot is completely inedible, bitter, tough, nasty. You can't chew it. You would spit it out instantly. And we, through plant breeding, somehow, you know, pre-Renaissance, quite a while back, developed an edible version of the carrot, many edible versions. And we consider that like, oh, that's just nature. You just go along the woods and pick your carrots and live on carrots. No, we invented the carrot, the modern fruit, all the potato varieties, the corn on the cob. Most all of the produce department is a complete human invention within the, you know, some amount of the past of the history, whether it's 1,000 years or 500 years, it's still pretty recent. But the most recent things include like dark chocolate. If you're over age 40, you remember that nobody liked dark chocolate until 20 years ago. And it became a cultural rage and a fad. And oh, it got, it's like red wine, resveratrol, dark chocolate. Oh, this is like, we got this idea. Somebody as a shorthand in research started talking about these compounds in these foods and calling them antioxidants. And boy, did that sell stuff. It's pretty on a magazine cover. You can make supplements. You can make foods. You can highlight health benefits that are unknown and kind of fanciful and get away with it. And it becomes cultural truth. And so these are new. The idea you're right to eat dark chocolate every day was just invented 20 years ago.
Wow. Well, you mentioned supplements, and that's always an interesting thing. You know, we personally have held the belief that we cannot get all the nutrients from food just because of the fact that we've invented a lot of it. We have nutrient crop decrease. So for you personally, or in your work, do you recommend supplements or use them?
Yes. Yes, very much so. And this is double-edged sword as well, because when you start getting the nutrients you need, your cells work better and their ability to sort of kick butt and get rid of this oxalate that's hanging around in the tissues can be improved. I have a totally unfounded theory, not based on anything except wild guessing, that some people get away with a full carnivore zero oxalate diet for 3 or 6 years because they're not using supplements. And so they don't quite have the metabolic heft to be bothered with clearing out the oxalates, and the system is keeping them in this. The immune system has this stuff hidden from other cells and try to hide it from itself. So it doesn't keep agitating the immune system. Because the big problem with having these little nano and microcrystals forming in our bodies is that the immune system doesn't like what they're doing to the region around that. You know, the cells around them would be affected. So it wraps them up in dead white blood cells and DNA from immune cells and insulates them from tissue. So they're sitting there quietly, not causing symptoms. And that's a good place to leave them if you can, but chances are we have so much, there's a lot of cleaning up to do. And when the body gets around to cleaning up, probably one aspect of that is how sensitive your immune system is to damage, how much the tissues are remodeling and turning over. And you may be in a growth phase and turning tissues over more or have more of the infrastructure if you have enough minerals and have enough B vitamins that really gets the mitochondria happy and the cells able to do more work and reproduce more quickly. And you may run into this oxalate clearing thing with the supplements. So that it's to say is you need calcium as a binder to get rid of oxalate. That's your main binder to help the body remove oxalate. You need calcium because you've made yourself calcium deficient. You need potassium. You need the trace minerals. You're going to need magnesium. And taking them is a great thing. I really encourage people to do that. And you might need to try them very slowly to see if they start increasing symptoms of oxalate removal from tissues. So there's a kind of careful process there. It's good to just start with the diet for a while, then starting adding calcium citrate with enough magnesium to make sure calcium isn't causing constipation. But a lot of people need B1. It's a very common deficiency. Potassium, B1, calcium, these are very common deficiencies. They're safe supplements to play around with. Getting enough salt is another important thing to do. And we use citric acid as the thing that dissolves oxalate and protects you from kidney stones. It protects you from excessive acidity around cells, because part of what's affecting how well cells metabolize and how well cells uptake nutrients and uptake glucose and things depends on the proteins and the membranes working well. And if you have a generalized acidity surrounding cells, it messes up those proteins, so messes up your metabolism. Taking a citric acid from lemon juice and citrate supplements can really help with that. Even acetic acid and vinegar can help with that. So there's lots of different things that are affecting your physiology. But yes, B vitamins, thiamine, and minerals can be really valuable.
I really appreciate with your approach is the take your time aspect of this, that none of this is going to be, an overnight cure. You're providing people with a lot of good things to start doing first and foremost, starting to research what are the oxalate foods in my diet. I mean, I think just taking that inventory alone is a game changer, and people will finally open up their eyes to, oh, wow, this is a real thing. And this could have been what's been causing a lot of these issues all along, which is really what I found so striking with all of the variety of issues and diseases that can be tied back to oxalates. I mean, it's crazy to think, about your own journey and how it's like, oh my gosh, maybe the whole time that I was suffering with this, it's because I've been eating like that. And even today, the repercussions are still showing up. Mm-hmm. So I think that your advice is spot on. And I think you gave a good example in the book too, of like somebody who actually a husband and wife situation, if I remember the story correctly, like she Rod started going Katie. Down the road. Yeah, go ahead. Would you mind just sharing that? I thought that was like perfect summation of what we're talking about.
Yeah. So she's, she's the one who does most of the shopping and decides what we're going to eat and makes dinner most of the time. And she's been a health nut trying to figure things out. And she heard me talk here in town and was really excited. Like, oh yeah, this is the thing. And so she changed their diet, and he kind of grumbled and didn't pick fights over it, but he maintained his absolute need for chocolate in the afternoon and celery and peanut butter at bedtime. Those are rituals of his day. She's not going to mess up his ritualized lifestyle. We all do this with food. And that was his boundary. Like, okay, as a spouse, we'll keep the peace. I'll eat whatever, but I'm going to have my way with my stuff. And so he did okay, but he was still having trouble with his hands. And he's a retired guy who's doing piano composition. That's his vocation now. And it was hurting him, and he was having trouble doing what he loves. And he kind of came to a talk I gave, and my husband testified about his carpal tunnel going away. And so this gave Ron the idea that he should give it a try and give up the chocolate. I'm like, Kitty, give him some yogurt and apples at bedtime. Give him another ritual. So give him something. Help him with that. So help him get past the peanut butter. And she got a kidney stone because she went so fast. Her body was clearing oxalate, and she was also postmenopausal. So that increases your risk of kidney stone to have less estrogen. And he did great when he got off his chocolate. He right away, his wrist pain went away.
Unbelievable. But I mean, I think that for those out there who are always concerned about going from 0 to 60, I'm not sure if I can make this jump. This sounds, too restrictive. It's right. Just even taking out those 1, 2, maybe 3 things that are daily staples or weekly staples, but not eliminating all of them. That right. Might be 3 things out of 6, but you just, reduced it by 50%, which is going to make a big difference in terms of the oxalate overload that your body has to contend with. And then giving your body the grace to clear this stuff slowly. I mean, I think it's just very, very encouraging. And that's what I loved about this. It wasn't about a diet where you have to just make this complete overhaul of your life, but rather focus in on this one very simple thing, yet something that nobody else is talking about as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would have thought that saying, look, you don't have to eat spinach would be an easy message. Like, who really, honestly, in your heart, truly loves spinach? No. Butter. I believe it. Butter, I would believe.
It's the butter and the garlic that makes it so good,
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we just think you are such a wealth of knowledge. I mean, I know I could personally sit here for another 2 hours listening to you. We appreciate your wisdom and your time. We want you to tell our listeners, which we will also include in the show notes, how do they get in touch with you? How do they take this assessment? And how do we get this book?
Yeah, so the book can be purchased anywhere. Just try to get the real book. There's been all this kind of mimicry and fake stuff out there. It's so interesting what's legal to do. So get the real book. You can buy it anywhere books are sold. Go to your local retailer. And if you yourself have a retail outlet, you can be a wholesaler and actually stock the book if you want to. They sold in cases, I think, 24 per box. And you can get an audiobook or an ebook. And so there's lots of ways to get it all over the world. To get to me, you can write to me through my website, which is sallyknorton.com. And there in the shop, you can find a PDF cookbook if you're looking for ideas of what to do with a cabbage or a turnip. We didn't talk a lot about the low oxalate foods, but there's quite a bit of guidance in the cookbook itself of how to do this. And then about 180 something recipes there. And the assessment inventory you can download for free, or if you get the book, you'll get it there as well. There's a dosing table in the book that'll help you add back. If you've gone full carnivore and you realize you need to like calm down, if you're having a lot of reactions and not feeling that well, try adding some tea or some olives or some carrots back in your diet. That's all there. I'm on Instagram if you want to say hi. I don't really have time for lots of food questions, but we are coming out with some data information to make that easier too. But literally, just the high oxalate list and the low oxalate food list is enough to really take you 90% there.
I love that. Well, guys, make sure you get out, you support Toxic Superfoods by Sally K. Norton. Make sure it's her. And do not clog up her Instagram with all those nutrition questions. I mean, you know, she's trying to go make a difference in the world. So take your questions, right? Use the resources that are being given. We so appreciate your time. And gosh, we just look forward to having you back on the show again.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that too. You guys keep track of your journeys with being oxalate aware. The oxalate aware journey has all these surprising twists and turns, and we need to check in every 6 months and see what's the latest. That'd be fun.
Absolutely. That sounds great. Well, everyone, I hope you guys really enjoyed this conversation as much as we did, and we will catch you guys in the next episode.
Hey guys, thanks for joining us. We're trying to do our part to build people up and take the overwhelm and confusion out of exercise and nutrition so people and their families can live fuller lives.
We've got an entirely free coaching course for you over at purephysique.com. So head over and share it with your friends.
And because we do the show entirely free and without sponsors, we'd super appreciate it if you would leave us a 5-star review, share this podcast with friends and on social, and be sure to tag us.
We'd love to know what you discovered today and how this information impacts you. Let's go!
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.